Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to FedSoc Forums. My name is Libby Dickinson, and I'm an Associate Director with the Federal Society's Practice Groups. As a reminder, all opinions expressed are those of our speakers and not of the Federalist Society. Today's program will be a discussion of the civil rights issues surrounding anonymity and masking. Today's moderator is Hans von Spakovsky, Senior Legal Fellow with the Edwin Meese III Institute for the Rule of Law at Advancing American Freedom. If our audience has any questions throughout the webinar that pertain to the topic at hand, please submit them through Zoom's Q&A feature located at the bottom of your screen and not the chat, so we'll be able to access them later. With that note, I will hand things over to our speakers to start the conversation. Hans, thank you so much for joining us today and for moderating today's conversation.
Well, thanks for inviting me. And before we get going, I do want to thank the Federalist Society for preserving what seems to be a fast disappearing American tradition. And that's the ability to have often vigorous but civil debate on very important and sometimes contentious issues. So I thank the Federalist Society for that. Now, if you read the summary posted on this session, it pointed to states trying to regulate federal agents and how they carry out their duties, particularly wearing masks. And this is very much directed at ICE agents. While at the same time, individuals wearing masks on campuses in some cases are being prosecuted, and we have to say that we have seen violence in many of these events. So what protection does anonymity have under the Constitution, the First Amendment, our civil rights laws? Is there a difference between anonymity when engaging in written speech and anonymity using masks in active protests in the streets? Is one of those protected or both protected? Does public safety override the other? Is there a difference between civilians and government agents? What powers do states have over federal agents? Before I introduce the speakers, I would like to draw folks' attention to two things. One, a Supreme Court case, and second, a federal civil rights issues that deal with these issues. The first is a old but well-known case from 1890 called In re Nagel, in which the U.S. Supreme Court said that federal officers can't be prosecuted by state authorities for carrying out their duties within the scope of their federal authority. That's actually an interesting case to look up if you haven't read about it, because it's like a Hollywood plot. A local California DA tried to criminally prosecute a U.S. Marshal who shot and killed a former member of the California State Supreme Court who was apparently trying to kill a member of the U.S. Supreme Court in California. The other statute that's relevant to this is Section 2 of the Ku Klux Klan Act of 1871. It's still in the law today, which says that if two or more persons in any state or territory conspire or go in disguise on the highway or on the premises of another for the purpose of depriving them basically of their rights, that constitutes a violation of federal law. Now, to talk about this, all of you are fortunate. We have two real experts on both the civil rights and the First Amendment. Ash Bhagwat, who is the Bukovir and Byrd Distinguished Professor of Law at the UC Davis School of Law, where he teaches administrative law, constitutional law, and economic regulation. He's got a BA from Yale College and a JD from the University of Chicago Law School, where he was articles editor of the Law Review. He clerked for very well-known judge Richard Posner of the Seventh Circuit and Anthony Kennedy at the U.S. Supreme Court. He's the author of The Myth of Rights, as well as Our Democratic First Amendment and Killing the Messenger, The War on Social Media. Bill Maurer is the managing attorney of the Institute for Justice's Washington State Office, where he has litigated constitutional cases across the country since 2002. He's also a nationally recognized advocate against the criminalization of poverty and government use of enforcement systems to raise revenue. He was a lead counsel in a class action against Pagedale, Missouri, where he secured a landmark consent decree that fundamentally reformed the city's ticketing and court systems. Ticketing and court systems that have been a matter of controversy in many towns and cities across the country. He also focuses on the First Amendment and has litigated at basically every level of the federal and state courts on campaign finance, political anonymity, and the regulation of political activity. He clerked for Washington Supreme Court Justice Richard Sanders and practiced at Perkins Coie. He's got a JD from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and a BA from Bard College. Now, before we started, we decided Bill would go first so he can give folks kind of a little more of the historical background about these issues. And then Ash will follow up with that. And then we will take questions from the audience. Bill, please go ahead.
So thank you, Hans. So I'm going to talk today first about the sort of the background on the idea of banning protesters' masks. And then I'm going to shift to the discussion of attempts to ban masks by federal law enforcement. The ban on protesters' masks has a much more historical basis, whereas the ban on federal officers wearing masks is a much more recent development. But both of these things kind of operate from the same assumption, which is that when a person is masked, that is something that actually changes not only how they act, but also how they're perceived. And it's long been recognized that anonymity emboldens people to commit acts, say things, or do things that they wouldn't ordinarily do if their identities were known. As the Georgia Supreme Court put it, public disguise is a particularly effective means of committing crimes of violence and intimidation. From the beginning of time, the mask or hood has been the criminal's dress. It conceals evidence, hinders apprehension, and calms the criminal's inward cowardly fear. A nameless, faceless figure strikes terror in the human heart. But remove the mask, and the nightmarish form is reduced to its true dimensions. The face betrays not only identity, but also human frailty. So that's kind of the idea behind all these things, is that essentially with a mask, you can have, what becomes a live action recreation of YouTube comments. People act really poorly. They can engage in violence because they know that there's not going to be the same level of responsibility and that they would if their identity was completely unknown. And it also makes masks it harder for police to identify criminals who commit crimes during demonstrations. It also makes it harder to identify police officers who commit crimes during arrests. And of course, there's the idea that masks can create public order and threats to the public order and fear. There's a reason why the Ku Klux Klan wears masked hoods. It is an intimidation tactic, that fear can be created whether or not any violence actually occurs. Those are the arguments for banning masks on both federal officers and on protesters. But there are a lot of arguments against having such bans. And I'll start with the protester mask bans. First is the most obvious one is that you have a right under the First Amendment to engage in anonymous speech. it is the U.S. Supreme Court has long recognized that anonymous speech is protected by the First Amendment, and laws that require people to reveal their identity can have a negative effect on their willingness to express opinions, especially opinions that are unpopular or go against the established political order. A case of McIntyre versus Ohio Elections Commission is really probably the strongest expression that the court has made. It's one of the most recent ones. But, you know, this is an idea that dates back all the way to the Federalist Papers, which were, of course, published under fictitious names. Related to that is that protesters oftentimes have well-founded reasons to conceal their identity. They can be undocumented immigrants, members of political, social, or ethnic minorities. They can be employees who fear workplace retaliation, or people that are just that the government just doesn't like. So mask bans for protesters effectively exclude some of the most vulnerable people from public participation, suppressing the very dissent that the First Amendment most directly protects. And the other issue, and we'll see this when I discuss the cases, is that mask bans are really fonts of poorly drafted legislation. They are oftentimes overbroad, and they can oftentimes raise significant issues of selective enforcement. This was the conclusion of the Florida Supreme Court in a case in 1980, which reversed a conviction under the state's anti-mask laws precisely because it was susceptible to application to entirely innocent activities. Are you wearing the balaclava because you want to break somebody's window, or is it because you're going to go skiing later that day? And then a new development is that facial recognition software and public CCTV cameras can identify people more effectively than ever before, making the chilling effect that much more stronger. So there's three kinds of mask bans regarding protesters. There's general bans, which makes it a crime to wear a mask in public regardless of your intent, subject to enumerated exceptions, holidays, theater, medical, religious. Oftentimes one that's called specifically out is Mardi Gras. And these are the ones that are most susceptible to overbreadth challenges and challenges regarding inconsistent application. Then there are intent-based bans, which makes mask wearing unlawful only when done for a specific purpose, such as to intimidate, to deprive someone of their civil rights, or to avoid identification while committing a crime. These are have been more likely to survive constitutional scrutiny, and sometimes courts even read general bans to narrow them to make them intent-based bans. And then there's cases, states that have laws that have simply sentence enhancements. If you commit a crime while you're wearing a mask, you have a not a standalone offense, but it is an enhancement of the crime that you are doing. There has been attempts in New Jersey, North Carolina, and Texas in response to the anti-Israel protests after the outbreak of the Gaza war. And there has been an attempt at a federal law, Representative McDowell's Unmasking Hamas Act from 2025, which specifically was geared towards that, which would have made it a federal crime of 15 years in prison for mass intimidation. That law did not advance. So as I mentioned before, the general laws generally get struck down. The more specific or intent laws generally get upheld. And sometimes the courts will read a law, a general law, to be a specific intent law That is one of the leading cases. That's what the Georgia Supreme Court did in one of the leading cases in this area. They read a very general mask ban to be narrowly applied only with regard to if there was an intent. So, and as we discussed, there has also been cases that have struck down laws, particularly where, and you'll see this in a lot of the cases, not just here, but also in the federal federal cases, it really, really matters who's wearing the mask. Generally, cases involving the Ku Klux Klan do not get overturned. But instances where general mask bans have been applied to people like Iranian protesters on U.S. campuses before the fall of the Shah, who feared that the Shah's secret police would target them if they were identified, those have been struck down by the courts because the courts felt that there was a legitimate reason for these people to have masks that were unconnected. These reasons were unconnected to intimidating people and more connected to preserving the safety of the people wearing the masks. So turning from that area to the ban on officers' masks, as Hans mentioned, this is a relatively new development. And the folks who have been pushing these bans have done so because they believe that having masked federal officers, these people are essentially accessing coercive power over individuals, including the power to arrest, detain, and use force. And therefore, they have to be identifiable. They have to be held accountable to account. And anonymity is incompatible with that kind of democratic accountability. Officers who know they can be identified are more likely to act lawfully and professionally, and federal agents did not routinely wear identity-concealing masks prior to 2025. Another reason is that if an officer is masked, it is easier to impersonate them. If you just have stuff that looks like you're an ICE agent, you can look like an ICE agent without actually being an ICE agent. And then there's also the constitutional right of detainees. People have a due process interest in knowing who is arresting them and what agency they represent. And then there's the issue, and this is connected to sort of the militarization of the police, of the erosion of public trust. Masked officers dressed like assault troops do not necessarily engender a great deal of public trust. It becomes less, it looks less like they're trying to protect and serve the public and more like they're attempting to intimidate them. The arguments against these laws, are the first and foremost one, and I think the most powerful one, is officers' safety and anti-doxing concerns. Publicly identified ICE agents face serious risk. Their names and addresses can be published online. This can expose them and their families to harassment, threats, and physical dangers. Immigration enforcement attracts intense public hostility. And DSHS cited increased reported assault on ICE agents in 2025, including an attempt to shoot some of them. Turning to the constitutional argument, there is the Supremacy Clause and intergovernmental immunity. And this is a legal, not a public argument. But the legal argument, quite simply, is the states cannot regulate the conduct of federal officers performing federal duties. We had what used to be called a national dialogue about this back in the 1860s. And the rule is simply that states cannot regulate the federal government unless the federal government says it's okay. And then there's the case of In re Nagel that Hans discussed. Quite frankly, one of the longest cases I've ever read. That case held very simply that federal officers acting within the scope of their authority are immune from state prosecution. A state mask ban that subjects federal agents to criminal or civil liability for performing their federal duties arguably conflicts with this principle, regardless of whether the ban is facially neutral or if it applies to state and local police as well. The one qualifier is from a Ninth Circuit case in 2000 involving the Ruby Ridge case, Idaho versus Hirauchi. I tortured that name. But the officers have to be acting reasonably when they're conducting the federal activity. And then there are questions of preemption and operational effectiveness, basically saying that forcing federal agents to unmask makes them less effective. So the states that have banned federal officers from wearing masks are California, Washington, New Jersey, Oregon, Connecticut. And there is an attempt right now in Virginia to enact a similar ban. This issue has only come to has only been litigated once. There's an entire backlog of cases that inform the analysis, but the only decision that has come out is that the Ninth Circuit in April of 2026 upheld an injunction, or it basically issued an injunction against California and forcing its mask ban against the federal officers. And it was a decision written by a Clinton appointee, I'm sorry, an Obama appointee and two Trump appointees with no dissents. It was very short, and it just simply held that states cannot regulate what the federal government does. They cannot directly tell the federal government what it can and can't do. And I believe that the Ninth Circuit overturned the part of the decision of the district court, and it also rejected the argument of the district court, which was that the problem with California's laws, it did not apply to California police officers, and therefore it was discriminatory against federal officers because it excluded California officers. This was the justification for Washington passing almost an identical law. The Ninth Circuit's decision rejects that pretty strongly and says that you can have a discriminatory law, but or a non-discriminatory law, but if it is directly regulating the conduct of federal officers, then it is unconstitutional under the Supremacy Clause. So with that, I will turn it back to Hans and await to hear what Professor Bhagwat has to say.
Well, thank you, Bill. That's a good background into both the state and federal issues here. Professor, now why don't you present to our audience with your opinions and your focus on this?
Sure. Thank you, Hans, and thank you to FedSoc for organizing this. As with many, many events, it's fantastic. So I don't have a lot to say about the state laws banning federal officers from wearing masks. It strikes me as being a no-brainer. They're blatantly unconstitutional. I agree with Bill that it's not great policy for law enforcement to just wear masks all the time. I think it's a bad idea, but I don't think there's any possible way that the states have a right to regulate the federal government in that context. And I will say, when I'm asked this question, imagine this is the South in the 1960s, and Southern governments are trying to regulate federal officers, and how would you react to that? And it has to be, the rules have to be the same. On the protester mask bans, I have a fair bit to say, unsurprisingly, because I'm a First Amendment guy. So it's important to recognize that even though the mask bans go back further, like New York had a mask ban in the 1840s, the modern laws are all about the KKK, right? That's the inspiration. The litigation tends to involve Ku Klux Klan members. And that, I think, shapes the conversation because it's about intimidation, right? And the KKK is a terrorist organization. It's always been about intimidation and sowing fear. And mask banning has always been associated with trying to avoid intimidation. But of course, if that's the purpose, flat mask bans are, of course, vastly overbroad because not all masked protesters are trying to intimidate anybody. And I do think something that Bill said that I want to emphasize is that there was a time, like the Second Circuit's Carrick case, where a court could casually say 25 years ago that prohibiting masks is not really directly the same thing as anonymity. We may have a right to anonymity, but we do not have a right to go masked in public because that's literally a line from the Carrick case. Jose Cabranes wrote that decision, great judge, but facial recognition changes everything. Because the reality is that with the pervasiveness of facial recognition technology today and AI and CCTVs, if you're not masked, you're not anonymous, period. There's no anonymity left, especially with respect to law enforcement, which has access to massive databases. If you are not masked and you're engaging in a protest in public, the odds are you can be very, very easily identified, both by law enforcement and by others. And that means that unless the right to anonymous speech, which as Bill correctly points out, is well established and goes back decades, unless it doesn't apply to protests, mask bans cannot be reconciled with Supreme Court precedent. I simply do not understand how that could be. How it could be that the cases involving pamphlets and anonymous pamphlets do not apply just as strongly to speech that's anonymous in public places. After all, that is, speech and assembly were as fundamental rights as any right to written speech. And so I think what we're going to see going forward is that these laws, unless they are limited to masking in a way that is intimidating or threatening, are going to be struck down. And I think this is particularly true, and I'm going to stop quickly, is a case called Americans for Prosperity Foundation versus Bonta, which the court decided about 5 years ago, held that at least in the context of making donations to nonprofits, there's a presumptive right to anonymity. You don't even have to prove that you're subject to retaliation in order to bring a First Amendment claim. And if that is true, in that context, I don't see why it would not be equally true in the context of public protest. And so, yeah, I think that going forward, mask bans are in trouble unless they are limited. And I'm particularly troubled by some of the modern legislation because targeting anti-Israeli protesters for wearing masks, that's viewpoint discrimination. That is about as clear a First Amendment violation as one can imagine. So I think that the case law is unsettled, but I think that in going forward litigation, these laws are likely to be struck down unless they're written very narrowly. And I'll stop there.
Thanks. Let me take the moderator's prerogative and ask a question or two. Bill, you touched on this a little bit, but I'm wondering, how much do you think modern communications technology is kind of changing the view on this issue? And I would point to the fact that, one of the things that can be done and has been done now, using, again, modern communications technology, the internet and social media, is that, for example, with law enforcement officers, modern technology allows you, if they're not wearing masks, to get on the internet and basically dox them and do things like direct people how to get to their homes, which can cause all kinds of problems. You know, this is similar to the issue that arose some years ago, I believe, Professor, in California, when there was a referendum on the ballot. California requires public disclosure of contributions made to support or oppose referenda. And that, of course, is a form of political speech when you make a donation. But apparently a group in California took the list of individuals who were donating against the referendum. It was a referendum on gay marriage, and created a website that actually gave people maps on how to get to the homes of these individuals. How much is technology, you think, potentially going to change the view of the courts, perhaps the Supreme Court, to this issue?
Well, you know, we've made this argument before. Essentially, the idea behind disclosure of campaign contributions, it used to be that you had to get into your car, you have to drive to the Secretary of State's office in your state capital. For me, that's an hour and a half drive, if I'm lucky. Right. And then go into the Secretary of State's office, sit down, ask for the stuff, and go through it, write everything down. I can get that now in less than 15 seconds and figure out what all of my neighbors' political donations have been. I can figure out where they work, where they live, and I can contact their employer. I can contact their neighbors. I can contact pretty much anyone and anybody. So far, the Supreme Court has been unreceptive to those arguments, particularly Justice Scalia, of course, saying, you know, being part of a political discussion requires some degree of political courage. But I think with the rise in violence in the United States around political discussion, I wonder if courts are going to start to rethink that and the ease by which people are able to obtain information about the political activities and understand that that requiring people to not be anonymous, it can be a significant deterrent, if not the most significant deterrent, political participation. And as Professor Bhagwat mentioned, though, there's a difference between sort of disclosure and anonymity. And so I think there is, until facial recognition becomes That issue won't bleed over into protesters, I think, until facial recognition becomes easily accessible to people who aren't the police or who aren't, you know, agents of foreign government. But once that happens, you're going to have stronger arguments, I think, for permitting people to protest anonymously in masks.
So I agree with all of that.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I agree with all of that. I think a distinction needs to be drawn. So first of all, these concerns that you pointed out, and you're talking about the Prop 8 campaign, which was actually 2008. It was a long time ago, right? That was relatively early in the age of social media. I think that those concerns very much drove the Supreme Court's decision in Americans for Prosperity Foundation, upping the right to anonymity. But I want to draw a distinction. Justice Scalia, in the case that Bill mentioned, he was talking about not donations, but signing petitions that get a proposition onto the ballot. And in that situation, he said there's no right to anonymity. And I actually agree with him on that. I think that's different. When you're acting when you're actually acting as effectively a lawmaker in the proposition process, you don't have a right to anonymity any more than members of Congress do when they cast votes. But where the real push and pull is going to come is in donations. Till now, the Supreme Court has consistently upheld disclosure requirements for when you donate to political candidates, and the only person who's really dissented consistently from those opinions is Justice Thomas. But in our age, you're right. Those disclosure requirements pose greater risks because of the problem of doxing that you mentioned. We'll see what happens. Coming back to protesting, which is our topic after all, I think that even before ordinary citizens get access to facial recognition technology, the fact that law enforcement has access is enough for me to raise a real problem. Because the reality is that law enforcement itself has its own biases. For example, they don't like anti-police protesters. Surprise, surprise. No one likes to be protested against. And so not being able to, for example, participate in a Black Lives Matter rally anonymously is an enormous burden under modern conditions. I think 30 years ago, completely different world. But under modern conditions, it's a very, very different world.
The other question I would put to you is the standard the review standard that the courts use, I mean, is it significantly different between when they're looking at anonymous political speech, political donations, that kind of activity versus more active First Amendment activity like engaging in a protest? I mean, is the legal standard the same? And even if the legal standard is the same, do you find courts, perhaps without realizing it, looking at these kind of situations differently?
But the law's a bit of a mess here. The court has recently been suggesting that in the context of disclosures of financial contributions and that kind of thing, the standard is something called exacting scrutiny, which, frankly, I'm not sure why we needed another standard, but it's something less than strict scrutiny, but still very high. Whether that would be the same standard applied to anonymity in protesting, who knows? Supreme Court has never taken one of these cases, right? So the Supreme Court is a blank slate. But my guess is logically the answer should be yes. Because when you're engaging in a protest, you're doing two things. You're not only speaking, you're also associating in assembly. And I think as a result, the association cases and the exacting scrutiny as an association test should actually apply to anonymous protesting. And that's a fairly strict standard. You can't just, the lesson of the Americans for Prosperity Foundation cases, blunderbuss across the board disclosure requirements are problematic precisely because of the problem of retaliation. And I think the same standard should apply and should invalidate broad-based bans on masking.
One issue that we haven't actually discussed much is that there's an expressive, it's not just protesting and association, but there's an expressive aspect to protesters and how they dress. This was an issue in a lot of the cases having to do with the Ku Klux Klan, who argued that, you know, dressing like a Klansman was part of their message. It was part of their political message. And unfortunately for them, and fortunately for the rest of us, I think, the courts said, well, you guys don't stop with masks. It's not just the fact that you're masked. You're able to express your membership in the Klan with all the other regalia that you use identify people, let people know that you're in the Klan, the hood, the robes, the symbols. And so therefore the mask ban is really not affecting your expression at all. And I wonder if that is going to be a distinction that somebody is going to make in the future, I don't think it's particularly persuasive. There was an interesting case here in Washington where a person argued that not wearing a mask was a form of political protest during COVID. That argument did not go anywhere, but it was an interesting argument, I think, that could be used in the future.
All right. Well, I don't have any more questions. So, Libby, I'm assuming you've gotten questions from folks watching. So why don't you throw some of those questions out?
Awesome. Well, I will definitely invite our audience to continue submitting questions. But we had an interesting one, just less of a question and more just, you know, wanting perspective on more of the normalization of masking since COVID. And I know there have been a lot of different points touched on so far in the discussion, but I was wondering if any of you had any further thoughts on that.
Well, I mean, obviously wearing a mask in public for health reasons, we're not going to prosecute people for that, right? I mean, because that's not meant to be intimidating. It's not intimidating any problem, but it points to a problem that Bill correctly points out is a real issue here, which is selective enforcement, which is that lots of people wear masks in public for lots of reasons, like skiing or, you know, like masking for health reasons, Halloween, Mardi Gras. And we don't prosecute those people. We're not going to arrest little kids going trick-or-treating in a mask, right? And so the question really does become, who gets prosecuted for masking? And that starts to raise some serious issues about who is being targeted, especially by law enforcement, right? And in a world in which, and this is a serious First Amendment over breath problem, in a world in which you could arrest thousands of people every day, but you're never going to, selective enforcement becomes, I think, a real issue.
That, if I could just follow up on that real quick. Well, Bill, I don't know if, did you have a comment on that?
No, please go ahead.
Okay. Well, let me just follow up on that very quickly. They were talking about wearing a mask having been kind of normalized because of COVID. In the cases that have arisen over mask bans, we have the one I talked about that's in the basically federal civil rights laws, but of course, many states have them also, Bill, as you outlined. Have there been defenses raised by individuals based on cultural norms of wearing a mask? Because as you know, the kind of outfits worn, for example, by those protesting in favor of Palestine, Gaza, Hamas, et cetera, they I think say that when they're wearing the kind of outfits they are, that's part of their culture. Have those kind of exceptions been raised as defenses, and what have courts said about it if they have?
So the statutes with which I'm familiar oftentimes have an exception for cultural expression. And so there's an automatic defense, arguably you're not committing a crime at all if you're wearing a mask for cultural expression, consistent with the, it's a full defense that I'm going trick or treating or I'm heading to Mardi Gras. And so it has not been an issue. It is going to, I think, become an issue. I saw an interesting video earlier today, actually, of a protester in front of a synagogue in, I believe it was Brooklyn. And there was one protester was clearly pro-Israel, had the kippah, and I believe he was draped in the Israeli flag. And if not, he certainly had blue and white clothing on. And he was being counter-protested or pro-protested by someone on the other side who was flashing very bright lights in his face. And he was wearing a mask. The person whose face was who was getting the light shown in his face was not. And you can argue, I was wondering actually while I was watching that, could he argue that this is part of the expression of his identity as a Palestinian or as a Palestinian protester? And how would that play in with attempting to demonstrate intent in laws that would make it that would make wearing a mask with the intent to intimidate people illegal? So it was an interesting issue, and I think at some point it's going to get litigated.
Yeah, I don't. The laws that have been either interpreted or written to limit banning masking when the masking is intimidating, is meant to be intimidating, those are laws of general applicability, and applying them to somebody who says, well, I'm masking for cultural or political reasons, I don't think that's going to be an effective defense. We're in the land of United States versus O'Brien, the draft card burning case. And when you have truly general laws, and I don't doubt that these are truly general laws, you don't get an out. And you certainly don't get an out under current law for religious reasons under the Smith case, because these are, again, laws of general applicability. So I don't think those defenses will be raised. I agree with Bill completely, but I don't think they're going to go anywhere.
Interesting. All right, Libby, have we got another question?
Not that I'm seeing a whole lot of. So again, I'll ask our audience if they have their questions to pop them in. Are there any, otherwise we can turn, if you either of our panelists have closing thoughts for this webinar, we can wrap up a little bit early. You guys just did such a great job covering everything.
Well, let me, while that's happening, let me ask another question. Bill, you're talking about an exception that the Ninth Circuit, I believe, had given, saying that when it comes to the immunity of federal officers, they have to be acting reasonably in carrying out their duties. Did the Ninth Circuit say we, the judges, will determine whether they are acting reasonably, or do they look to the standards of conduct that the federal government has laid out for its agents to decide whether the agent was acting within those guidelines and whether those guidelines were reasonable?
Well, it's an interesting question under that particular case, because this had to do with Ruby Ridge. And if you remember, there was an FBI sniper the standards were that they were not to shoot into the house. They were not, because they didn't want to hit women or children. And there were a whole bunch of restrictions on how they could act. And the sniper here fired at one of the men, either just at that second, or he missed. He ended up shooting a woman in the head who was holding an infant, and killing her. Thankfully, the infant survived. And the issue was essentially the same one in In re Nagel, which was, you know, can Idaho prosecute this sniper for murder? Or actually, I believe it was manslaughter, because there was no intent. And in Ninth Circuit, the panel initially said, no, they cannot. Even though this is a law of general applicability, on banc, in an opinion written by Justice Kaczynski, Judge Kaczynski, said that no, they have to be acting reasonably. And I believe part of the issue was, and I don't want to mix this up with Waco, is that the standards that the FBI were using were actually disowned by the FBI. So even if they were following what the FBI said is the proper way to go, that didn't necessarily save them. And in the end, the court literally said, yes, they have to be acting reasonably. What happens now? And that is right. Precisely what your question is. And they sent it back to the trial court to determine whether the person was acting within a range of reasonableness, because the Ninth Circuit wanted nothing to do with attempting to determine how a FBI agent acts reasonably or not. So that's still an open area. And it's a question of how broad is reasonableness? Is it a very strict standard? Is it very loose? I would imagine it's probably very loose. I think that's another area where we're going to see some litigation.
Let me ask the two of you a question, which I don't want to have to give an answer that gets you into political trouble. But look, the law on federal immunity from states, in other words, the inability of states to basically regulate how federal agents carry out their duties, it seems pretty clear. And yet, Bill, you mentioned, half a dozen states, including California and others, who have passed laws doing this. And I guess the question is do the legislators, are they just ignorant of federal supremacy law on this issue? Is this just a political grandstanding by them to make it look as if they are concerned and trying to do something about it, even though they know it's almost certain they'll get defeated in the courts? Or is it something where they are hoping to actually challenge that established law and perhaps get precedent overturned? I mean, I know it's pure speculation on your part, but I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts one way or the other about that.
I think one thing to bear in mind is it's very important not to overestimate the sophistication of the average state legislature, right? They're not, these are people who do not have the kinds of staffs that Congress people have. They don't have nearly, you know, most of them are not lawyers. I mean, some of them are, many of them are not. So to expect things like federal supremacy to be something that sort of was part of their general understanding, I think, no. Governors are different, right? Governors do have staff. They do have advice. Is some of this performative? Of course it is. And we see the same on the right, right? We see, like, for example, the efforts to regulate social media right after President Trump's deplatforming. A lot of people knew those laws were going to be struck down, but it didn't matter, right? This is just sending a message to constituents. Where there, for example, the California law that singled out federal officers, nobody thought that was going to be upheld, right? There's more, I think it's clearly not going to be upheld either way, but there are at least arguments to be made that if you regulate state and federal officers the same way, maybe that would be okay. I think Dean Chemerinsky made such an argument in print. I disagree with it, it's very hard to say how to get into people's heads, but I think it's a mixture of both. In some cases, there is lack of awareness, and in some cases, there is we need to send a signal regardless.
And I'm glad you brought up Professor Chemerinsky's article, because that's exactly his argument was that these are almost certainly all unconstitutional, but it's important to pass them anyway, because it's important that states need to register their displeasure with the actions of the federal government. Not sure passing an blatantly unconstitutional law is the right way to do that. Maybe sending a strongly worded email might be a better way. That's at least one of his arguments. And I know in Washington, since I live there, the state legislature actually believed that they were passing a constitutionally sufficient law because they were following the decision of the district court in California, which had struck down California's law because it exempted state officers from the mask ban that applied to federal officers. So they thought, okay, well, we'll write one that applies to Washington state police, state troopers, and local police officers. And then that rug was completely pulled out from under them with the Ninth Circuit's decision in U.S. versus California. So whether they thought that was going to work, some of them probably did. And I think some of them probably didn't care whether it was going to be upheld or not for the purposes that they wanted to send a message.
I guess my final question, unless Libby, we have any more from the audience. My final question to the two of you is, are there any cases developing in any of the states that have passed a mask ban or other regulatory restrictions on federal aid? Are any of them, you think, headed towards the Supreme Court? It doesn't sound like it, but I'm wondering whether you think there are any that might make it there.
Are we talking about laws regulating federal officers? Or are we talking about
protesters? Yeah, well, the ones that say that they can't wear masks.
That federal officers can't wear masks.
Yeah.
Oh, unless there's a circuit split, I don't see why the Supreme Court has to take that up. And I don't envision a circuit split.
I would agree with that. I think there's enough issues with the mask bans on protesters that it may eventually there may be differences among the circuits. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of that will depend, as Professor Bhagwat has pointed out, on how the laws are written, and are they directed at a particular message or not, or what is the standard for intent, or do they have a standard for intent? So I could easily see those issues starting to germinate more, especially if there's another round of protesting that involves a lot of property damage and mass protesters.
And I'm assuming that in those kind of cases, the challengers might be asserting claims under either the U.S. Constitution or potentially their state constitution, depending on how they're written, and or both, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. All right, well, Libby, any other questions from the audience?
I think that about wraps us up for today, but I wanted to be sure to thank both of our panelists one more time for great. Joining and sharing their experience and expertise on this very important issue. And thank you, Hans, for moderating. If our audience is interested in learning more about all of our programming here at the Federalist Society, please visit our website at fedsoc.org. That is FEDSOC.org. Or feel free to send us your feedback. We always love to hear it at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.